It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Lars.
Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
On the Lars Larson Show, which is, he's a conservative talk radio host.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
Honestly provocative talk.
This is a very big deal.
With Lars Larson. Larson.
Don't sit yet, you're going to like this.
No. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday night. And because it's going on right now, let's go right to the Rose Garden at the White House, where President Trump has been holding a press conference. I've got a couple of things to say about that, but let's go first to the President of the United States.
Which was very nice. Other countries sent us things that I was very surprised at, very happily surprised. We learned a lot. We're learning a lot. And we're also learning that the concept of borders is very important, Steve. It's very important. Having borders is very, very important. But we have done an incredible job. The economy is going to come back. My focus is saving lives. That's the only focus I can have. We're going to bring the economy back, and we'll bring it back fast. Yeah, please.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. You've said several times that the United States has ramped up testing. Just talk a little quicker or a little louder. Mr. President, you said several times that the United States has ramped up testing, but the United States is still not testing per capita as many people as other countries like South Korea. Why is that, and when do you think that number will be on par with other countries?
Yeah, well, it's very much on par. Per capita, we have areas of country that's very wide. I know South Korea better than anybody. It's a very tight. Do you know how many people are in Seoul? Do you know how big the city of Seoul is?
30 million.
38 million people. That's bigger than anything we have. 38 million people all tightly wound together. We have vast farmlands. We have vast areas where they don't have much of a problem. In some cases, they have no problem whatsoever. We have done more tests. I didn't talk about per capita. We have done more tests by far than any country in the world, by far. Our testing is also better than any country in the world. And when you look at that, as simple as that looks, that's something that's a game changer. And every country wants that, every country. So rather than asking a question like that, you should congratulate the people that have done this testing, because we inherited, this administration inherited, a broken system, a system that was obsolete, a system that didn't work. It was okay for a tiny, small group of people, but once you got beyond that, it didn't work. We have built an incredible system to the fact where we have now done more tests than any other country in the world, and now the technology is really booming. I just spoke to, I spoke to a lot. I'm not going to even mention. I spoke to a number of different testing companies today, and the job that they've done and the job that they're doing is incredible. But when Abbott comes out and does this so quickly, it's really unreal. In fact, one company, I have to say, that stands out in the job, and I think I can say this, I don't want to insult anybody else, but Roche. Roche has been incredible in the testing job they've done, and they're ramping it up exponentially. It's up, 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 up. And you should be saying congratulations instead of asking a snarky question, because I know exactly what you mean by that. You should be saying congratulations to the men and women who have done this job, who have inherited a broken testing system and who have made it great. And if you don't say it, I'll say it. I want to congratulate all of the people. You have done a fantastic job, and we will see you all tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Okay,
Thank you. That is
President Donald Trump at a press conference. And I understand the point of the question, but at this point, it's almost as though the press is looking for any way to say, we gotcha. Well, you're not doing as many tests per capita. Well, we've done more tests than anybody else in the world, including China. And by the way, about China, you understand, China lied about the coronavirus, about the China virus. In fact, we might as well call it the CCP, the Communist Chinese virus. This thing has done so much damage in China and in the rest of the world, and the rest of the world has had to deal with it. And China, if it had told the truth to the rest of the world in a timely fashion, we could have met this challenge much better. We would have had weeks of advance warning of this problem. Instead, China kept it a secret. And you've heard me detail that Taiwan warned the World Health Organization about this threat in late December. And yet, as late as middle January of this year, the WHO, which is beholden to the Chinese for whatever reason, the WHO came out and said there's no sign of human-to-human transmission. That ought to go down in history like we have to pass the bill to find out what's inside of it. Now, I want to tell you something else that's happened. And this happened during the press conference that just wrapped up at the White House in the Rose Garden. The president spoke. He had members of the coronavirus task force speak. And then he had a number of people up. The head of Honeywell was there. They're the company that makes, among other things, the masks that everybody is using, the N95 masks. Now, there are other companies that make them, but Honeywell is one of the major manufacturers. 3M is one of the major manufacturers. One of the people the president invited to speak today in the Rose Garden is a guy by the name of Mike Lindell. You have heard Mike Lindell on this program before, and you've probably heard Mike's story. He's associated with a company that actually advertises on our program, so I have a dog in the fight, and I fully disclose the dog in the fight. I don't think Mike would mind me calling my dog in the fight. But the fact is, Mike Lindell took his factories that make pillows, and he said, I can go to making masks. He took 75% of the manufacturing capacity of his company, and he turned it to what America needed at this moment, and that is masks for emergency responders, for doctors, for nurses, for lab techs, for all the people who are trying to save lives right now. Now, do you know anybody who has turned 75% of the manufacturing capability of their private company? The president didn't go to him and say, I'm going to use the National Defense Production Act and order you to do this. Mike Lindell said, we can go from making pillows and bed sheets and that sort of thing to making the masks that America needs right now. So he gets an invite to the White House. And do you know what the press corps did? Many of the members of the press immediately got on Twitter and began ridiculing the guy. Oh, there's the My Pillow guy. What the heck is he doing there? CNN, the Chicken Noodle News Network, they literally, when Mike Lindell stood up to start speaking, he is a face that's known throughout this country, they literally cut away from the press conference and went back to Wolf Blitzer in the studio. And why? Because the president of the United States chose to recognize a private entrepreneur, and you've heard his story on this program before. He's a guy who a decade ago was a crack addict. He was a drug addict. He pulled himself out of addiction. He took a dream for a product. And I'll tell you something about the product. Yes, I like the product. Yes, I've done ads for the product. Yes, I use the product myself. But many people who decide to go into a business, they will be told, if you're going into a business where everybody else in the world makes that product already, you're going to have a tough time. But Mike Lindell went into the pillow business. How many centuries have human beings been manufacturing pillows? I don't even know right offhand. But he goes into the pillow business. He completely makes something brand new. Something so attractive that literally tens of millions of Americans have voluntarily purchased it. And when his country runs into a problem like China virus, he says, I can turn our factories to making the kind of masks that will save the lives of emergency responders so they can protect the people under their care. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to have you with me. If you want to jump in, it's 866-439-5277. Email go to talk@LarsLarsen.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails in a moment. If you want to dial in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I've told you that there are a few countries that have done an exceptionally good job of keeping coronavirus out as much as possible and battling it on the inside when it does get inside. Israel has done a very good job, so has Taiwan. South Korea has also done a very admirable job. They battled with the coronavirus, and they appear to have won. But as one of the few countries who flattened the curve, what can we learn from them now that we're in our own war with this invisible enemy? And the numbers worldwide, 778,000 people infected, and in the United States, more than 150,000. And those numbers are up dramatically from just a week ago or even a day ago. Well, Bruce Klingner joins me now, former CIA Korea deputy chief and Heritage Senior Fellow, Research Fellow. Bruce, good to have you back.
Well, thank you very much for having me again.
Can we talk about some of the lessons that we might learn from Seoul, South Korea, from South Korea, but Seoul in particular, about flattening the curve and about, number one, keeping the virus out, and number two, identifying it, tracking it down, and isolating it once it gets in?
Yes, there are a number of things that South Korea did that really helped them, which some may not be or we may not want to replicate in the U.S., but the first thing was they took action very quickly. The first case of COVID virus was discovered in both South Korea and the U.S. on the same day, January 20th. But South Korea really moved into action very quickly. Within a week, they had convened a meeting with representatives from 20 medical companies and called on them to come up with a testing program very quickly. They didn't have a lot of red tape, unlike in the U.S., and a week later, they had given approval to the first of the medical companies to start putting out these test kits. At one point, they were doing 10 to 20,000 tests a day at a time when weeks after they started, the U.S. still hadn't even done that cumulatively. And South Korea had even drive-by or drive-through testing stations where you drive in, you didn't even get out of your car, and 10 minutes later, you're done, and you would have the results within a few hours.
Bruce, let me ask you about why it worked differently here. And I think I know some of the answers, but I want to hear it from you. As I understand it, the FDA said, we don't want the private companies at this point. We will develop our own test. So rather than meeting with private industry, which moves a lot faster than government, the FDA said, we'll do it. They then came out with a test that was flawed. And then they had to go back and retrench. And at that point, my understanding is they did say to the private companies, now you can get in, but again, you have to come through the government for approval. So I guess one of the ironies I see is I see a lot of reporters who assume if there's a problem, the government is the best to solve it. And yet in this case, when South Korea went to the private sector and said, look, come up with a test and we'll start using it very quickly, the private sector did that. In the United States, the government decreed the private sector isn't welcome in this discussion to a large degree. We will come up with a government-produced test, and they didn't, and we ended up in more trouble because of that. Is that fair? Is that a fair assessment of how it went?
I think that's fair. So the South Korean government did move very quickly. And they had learned a lot of lessons from the MERS outbreak that they suffered in 2015. At that time, the administration, which was in office, took a lot of criticism for not having enough testing kits and not moving quickly. So not only was the new administration in Korea more likely to move forward, Korea had implemented a number of new laws that gave the government a lot of access to personal information that enabled them to monitor people, the location of people and their whereabouts, so that if they tested positive, then they could notify people throughout the city or the surrounding area where they had been. And that's sort of the downside, is sort of very intrusive monitoring that I don't think the people in the U.S. would want. But on the positive side, as you point out, the government really embraced working with industry and let them go ahead, and they were very quickly able to produce test kits.
Bruce, that's one of the things that so impressed me about Taiwan, because they were doing things that I thought, well, Americans wouldn't necessarily like that, but if they understood it saved lives, like they started going on airplanes on New Year's Eve, for goodness sake, before 2020 had even started, because they had direct flights from Wuhan, and they knew about a brand new kind of pneumonia that was coming in from Wuhan, and they said, let's get on top of this now. But the other thing they've done is they're able to use people's smartphones. And it's the kind of tracking that I know Americans will get their back up against. But they say, if we ask you to go home and self-quarantine, we're going to keep an eye on your smartphone so that we can enforce that quarantine. And to a large extent, the Taiwanese government has even given citizens more ability to make their own decisions. But if you decide to do things that are going to put other people at risk, they have a better ability to find you when you have done that. And say, no, you can't do that. You're putting other people's lives at risk, which is kind of a nice balance. Whereas in the United States, we've literally got people in some parts of this country, even in the area where I am, an affluent country, who've been waiting 18 days to get the results of a COVID test, which, as you said, in Korea 2 months ago, they were turning around in 10 or 20 minutes.
Right. And the thing with the monitoring and then the notification in Korea, you can make a good argument both pro and con. It's amazing when you read some of the reports that people will tell about is, for example, one reporter said, yeah, he got a notification on his phone that someone in his neighborhood tested positive. And that individual had ridden this bus, had gone to this noodle shop where he ate without wearing a mask. He went to the bank that this reporter goes to. And you could track this person's movements, which is either very helpful in determining whether you would have come into contact with him at that at the time he was at those locations, or it's kind of frightening to see a government having access to your credit card purchases, your bank activity, the GPS of your phone, and your car. So, that would be a debate that I think we're going to have perhaps after we flatten the curve or whatever. That how intrusive do we want the government to be able to monitor our location, our business activity, if it serves the benefits of society? I think that's a debate we're going to have.
I mean, because one of the things I noticed, Bruce, was the report coming out of South Korea. They said they went to somebody who was reported as, well, I left Wuhan 3 weeks ago. This is an older gentleman. And they asked him, who have you been in contact with? He named a bunch of people. But he left two or three people out, apparently inadvertently, had forgotten he'd had contact with them. And I think most of us would have that experience. If you came to me right now, well, I've been at home for the last 4 weeks. But if during my regular daily activities, if somebody said, list all the people you've spoken to in the last 2 weeks, it'd be very difficult to have a comprehensive list. But if you have these other data gathering abilities, you could say, well, didn't you also talk to Bruce Klingner? You and he appear to have had coffee. Oh yeah, and that might actually protect your life. So like you said, it's a conversation about how intrusive we're going to allow the government to be if the purpose they're putting it to is actually to protect your life or the life of somebody else.
Exactly. And then, I think there would be concerns that people would have of, well, will the government only have access to my credit card information during a crisis, or would it use that information other times? Just think of when people get very nervous when we find out Facebook has been sharing our information or using our information, or it's been hacked, or, you find out that people are getting access to your information. Or even just when pop-up ads come up that, based on your own shopping activity, people tend to get pretty nervous. But, as you point out, it's for the greater good, but there's the danger or the fear that government might use it for other purposes.
Well, and look, I completely understand that. On the other hand, if somebody called me on the phone right now and said, by the way, a couple of weeks ago you were meeting with this person, and he says he talked to you, and then he found out he had coronavirus the next day, it's probably somewhat intrusive to get the phone call from the government, but I think most of us would be glad if we got the heads up you might actually have this. And if you have it, well, let's get you looked at and get you some treatment right now. And I think, if anything, protecting my life actually is my original civil liberty, the right to be alive. Bruce Klingner from the Heritage Foundation. In a moment, we'll talk to our friend Comrade Juan Williams. It's been about a year since the Mueller report. Has America actually moved on from this? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And on the phone with me right now is our friend and political opponent, Comrade Juan Williams from Fox News. You see him on The 5. You may have seen his book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. And yes, he's a bit different politically than I am. Juan, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. The governor in Virginia has just apparently shut us down for like 70 days. I mean, this is wild. I mean, what a time we're living through. The governor in Maryland, a Republican, he said tonight at 8 o'clock, go out of your house. And, of course, in D.C., the mayor, Muriel Bowser, says the same thing now. So the whole area is like in lockdown.
Hey, that's bipartisanship, right?
I mean, this is one of those moments where I know partisanship always comes up. We live in a polarized era. But this is one moment where I think more and more people are saying, you know what, we're Americans. We got to hold hands here on this one.
Hey, I agree with you. I mean, the COVID virus or the China virus or communist China virus, if you prefer, Juan, I don't know if you like that interpretation or not. I kind of do. It doesn't care if you're Republican or Democrat. It cares if you're young or old. It does care if you have underlying health conditions or not. And amazingly, the media has been a little colorblind on this one in not saying, look, it hits old people, but it also hits young people, like the baby who apparently died of coronavirus in Chicago. And you say, oh, it's all old people. No, not quite.
Not true. And in fact, the baby died in New York today. To back up what you're saying, Lars, it's like 40% of the people with coronavirus in the hospitals are under the age of 50.
Yep.
I mean, so it's not just the elderly, but the elderly are particularly vulnerable. You know, the other thing I would say that's a surprise to me, men more vulnerable than women.
Yeah, that is interesting because, you know, Juan, I've been working at home the last 4 weeks because I took my own, advisories early. And I said, look, I might as well get off the street. And I got my crew off the street as well and said, we'll all work from home. And except for one who has to go to the studio, but we've got other ways of protecting him. But I noticed that in the state of Oregon, where our studios are located that I normally use, it's actually a higher percentage of women who've come down with coronavirus. So it's picking some weird favorites in different locales. Now, that could just be population and a number of other things. But you pointed out in the piece that you wrote for thehill.com that a bunch of political anniversaries have gone by, like the Mueller report 1 year. And I noticed we went right past the 10-year birthday of Obamacare, which is largely gone anyway, thank goodness. It's wiping out an awful lot of what people normally care about in politics right now, isn't it?
There's no question. That's why, it's interesting. Right now, when the president had the press conference today, it got a little political. And I think he didn't want it to be that political. He didn't want it because then it opens up the door for his political critics to say, hey, he's politicizing it. And what he wants right now is to be seen as our president, the commander-in-chief fighting this invisible enemy. So it's like in everybody's best interest right now to tamp it down and say, what's the reality? What can we do to help each other? Because, one of the ways that it is political is it started on the East Coast, West Coast, and then mostly in areas that were won by Hillary Clinton, so what you would call blue states.
Right.
But now, increasingly, it's coming into the middle of the country and coming into the red states. And I think hopefully you're going to see people take precautions in line with that and not buy into any kind of partisan interpretation of what it means to not shake hands and the like.
Well, believe me, Juan, I've been getting my share of emails from people saying, this is a blue state thing or a red state thing. And I said, no, it's a virus. It doesn't care what your political registration is. And by the way, did you watch the ceremony on Saturday? I watched it on television with everybody else as the president sent the comfort off to New York. And I thought, he's incredibly presidential. You've got to give him props for the way that he messaged this is a ship that wasn't supposed to be ready for 4 weeks, and they apparently got it ready in 4 days. And there were folks saying, oh, he'll never be able to get it to New York by today. Oh, yeah, it's right there.
There is. I think that's a real positive. And, you know, so from my perspective, I wish it had been done earlier, but that's not going to stop me from saying, congratulations, this is what we need. This is what New York needs. And this is what the government should be doing. I think that sometimes people on your side of the aisle say, oh, you know, we don't need the government. Do away with the government. Oh, look, this is when we need government the most. And one other thought, April 1st is right around the corner here. A lot of rents are due, bills to be paid.
Yep.
And I'm so glad that we have made an effort in the Congress, again, bipartisan, to get money to people who are out of work, because it's unbelievable how many people are out of work right now.
It's stunning. But although, Juan, I have to say this about the government. I don't hate the government, but I look at it like a tool. I've got lots of tools in my shop. One of them is a hammer. But if you walk around with a hammer thinking everything's a nail and that that tool will work on everything, I just finished doing an interview just before you came on about some really colossally stupid mistakes that were primarily driven by the FDA and the CDC. Because back in January, they said, oh, we don't want the private sector involved in this. We'll come up with a CDC test. Well, they goofed big time, and it's cost people's lives. China, South Korea, on the other hand, on January 20th, called a meeting of all the private sector medical companies and biotech companies, said, hey, we need a test. We need it right now. And all these companies went out and did what is now being done, which is private industry is stepping up. But before, the government, these government agencies were literally saying, we don't want private industry involved in this. The government will do it. Well, this is where our my skepticism, maybe not yours, about government comes. When you have a government agency that says, we're going to drive things, and the CDC and the FDA screw things up, whereas South Korea says, hey, we'll bring in private industry. And now you see Mike Lindell at the White House, you see Abbott Labs, you see Roche and all these other companies that have said, you need ventilators? We can make those. You need a test that'll work in 5 minutes? We can do that. You want some masks? We can do that too. All of that is very capable with private companies. Government agencies, not so much. Would you agree?
Well, I wish the government had mobilized to ask them for help earlier. And I think when you see CDC, National Institutes of Health, they put out that test that was faulty, didn't work. They thought they had a good test. World Health Organization said, we have a test. The U.S. government said no. So, I mean, that's failure of government. But on the other hand, they were acting, and that's what I really wish had happened earlier, that we were acting more proactive than we have been. And now that we get these companies together and that we are getting them in gear, apparently still having trouble with GM and some of the others, but some of them are getting active now, and I'm grateful as an American. I just think, you know, this is what we need. We need all hands on board.
Yep. And by the way, did you notice that China pumped out a bunch of tests and sent them off to, I think, Poland and Czechoslovakia and said, hey, here's some cool Chinese tests that have turned out to be wrong 70% of the time, which means even
I hadn't heard that.
Oh, yeah. The country that was the biggest, you know, that was the first where this all started, where they lied to us and kept us in the dark for a long time. And now they're pumping out tests that are faulty, masks that are faulty. The Chinese, I frankly do not trust that government. The Chinese people are perfectly nice, but their government is just about as evil as it gets.
Well, that's why I don't understand why Trump keeps saying he's talking to President Z and if everything is fine, and he criticizes reporters who say, why do you trust the Chinese? I don't get it.
I don't
Maybe
think
he
does trust the Chinese, but I think there are times where you can put a smile on your face and say, why, we're working with them, while at the same time you're telling them, look, we don't trust you as far as we can throw you, so watch yourself, because we understand China lied and people died. Juan Williams, you see him on the 5. His book is called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? And when we come back, now that the FDA has approved some drugs for coronavirus, should states reverse their ban?
Lars.
Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
On the Lars Larson Show, which is, he's a conservative talk radio host.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
Honestly provocative talk.
This is a very big deal.
With Lars Larson. Larson.
Don't sit yet. You're going to like this.
No, no. Here's Lars Larson.
Do you think there is blood on the president's hands, considering the slow response? Or is that too harsh of a criticism?
I think that's a little too harsh. I think what's happening is the failure to, as I watched a prelim to your show, where someone said that, used the phrase that the president just thinks out loud. He should stop thinking out loud and start thinking deeply. He should start listening to the scientists before he speaks. He should listen to the health experts. He should listen to his economists.
That's the man who is the presumptive nominee for the Democrat National Party's nomination for President of the United States. And this is the Lars Larson Show. I wanted you to hear that because Chuck Todd, who looks at Joe Biden, in that interview over the weekend and says, does the president have blood on his hands? And then he gave Joe Biden an easy out from the question. Believe me, I've been asking questions of people for a long, long time in my business. And I don't give people those easy outs in most cases. If I wanted to ask Joe Biden, do you think the president has blood on his hands? You'd say just that. And then Joe Biden can decide how to answer. Instead, Chuck Todd not only wants to say, in some ways, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of a really cheap lawyer trick where a lawyer will be standing in court, usually on the defense side of the table, and he's defending a criminal. Most lawyers do defend criminals. Most lawyers do not defend innocent people. Most of the people who are charged with crimes in this country are not innocent. Most of them are guilty. In fact, I've talked to defense attorneys about that. And they want to say something to the jury, but they know they can't get away with saying it. So they ask a question that they know is going to be shot down by the judge, by an objection from the prosecution or whatever. So they throw it out there. Chuck Todd wanted to say the president has blood on his hands. Then he doesn't ask that question of Joe Biden. He says, is that too harsh? And Biden agrees, yes, that was too harsh. But you know what Chuck Todd accomplished? He managed to put that thought in people's minds. Donald Trump has blood on his hands. Now, I would love to interview Chuck Todd and say to him, in exactly what way do you think the president has blood on his hands? Did he create the China virus? Was he slow in responding to it? And then I would remind him that President Trump responded to the coronavirus, China virus, communist Chinese virus, whatever you want to call it. President Trump was one of the first on the ground to start responding to the China virus. And he did it despite the fact that he got criticized for doing it. Joe Biden himself. And I wish Chuck Todd had asked him this. Joe Biden himself, when the president slammed down the gate and said, no more flights from mainland China, bring Americans home, but Chinese nationals, you need to stay out of our country for right now. And to remind you, in case you don't know the scope of this thing, back before the president slammed the gate on January 31, long time ago at this point, we had about 10,000 Chinese nationals coming into the United States every single day of the week. 10,000 people every single day. And the president slammed the gate. Joe Biden declared it to be fear of foreigners, xenophobia. Now, the media love that. They love the fact that Joe Biden's saying that's xenophobia. The president's a racist. We've been saying that for 3 years. Now we've got proof. And it was only later when the media could see that what the president did made all kinds of common sense. It had nothing to do with race. It had to do with there is a disease threat over there, and we don't want it to come over here. It's about that simple. And yet Joe Biden is asked, does he have blood on his hands? Why? Because he responded early, and all of you called him a xenophobe for having done it? Is it because some government agencies failed to operate? Well, you don't want to be Joe Biden and start criticizing government agencies. Liberals love government agencies. In any case, welcome to the program. You know, online schooling does not work out for every class of students. should a solution be a free and easy A for those hardworking students in college, as well as the slackers? We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Doctors and nurses are working around the clock to beat the China virus, but in the midst of the chaos, should they be worried about a lawsuit, or should they get some protection? I'll tell you my take on that. And if you're looking for a new show to watch to pass the time during the coronavirus outbreak, we'll talk later on with the star of Wicked Tuna, who's going to tell us why you should tune in. And cast a vote in my Twitter poll. You'll find it two places. If you like Twitter, at Lars Larson Show. If you're not a fan of Twitter, LarsLarson.com is an alternative. Should college students and unemployed adults get a check like everybody else from the stimulus plan? Tonight's Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. AMAC has the conservative values I've always believed in. You should join the group I joined years ago, amac.us, or 888-262-2006. But Chuck Todd asking actually a fairly strong question. I would have been interested to hear what Joe Biden had said if Chuck Todd had simply said to him, does the president have blood on his hands? And then I would love to ask Joe Biden, explain to me exactly what it is that Donald Trump did that killed people in this country. Or was it the slow response of governors and mayors and cities and government agencies that actually has killed a lot of people? The second thing that I want to call Joe Biden out on, and this is because later on this summer, I fully expect the Democrat Party to name Joe Biden as its nominee for president. On Twitter this weekend, he said this. I'll read the quote from Twitter exactly. I'm issuing this challenge to the president. In the next 48 hours, direct the production and distribution of respirator masks, gloves, protective face shields, and gowns to fill every supply request made by a governor to the federal government. Lives are at stake. You know how I responded to that? I said, so Joe Biden wants Donald Trump to order private companies to do what they are already volunteering to do? Should we start calling the Daffy Delawarean Joe Maduro after the president of Venezuela? Or maybe Captain Obvious fits better. How about we make him secretary of the Department of Redundancy Department? He wants to go out and order private companies to do what they are already voluntarily doing. How does that do any good? You know, in this time when you're worried about getting sick, sleep is a key to your health and well-being, especially during this time. Sleep Number has shifted CTAs from in-store experience to visiting online at sleepnumber.com. That way you can get a great bed and you don't have to go to the store. When you're not feeling well, doctors will tell you the most important thing you can do to recover is get a great night's sleep. And as somebody who slept on a Sleep Number bed for 21 years, I can tell you it provides the best night's sleep you can imagine. Sleep Number beds allow you to adjust each side. Tina and I have been doing that for more than 21 years. Tina's Sleep Number is usually 45 or 50. Mine is always a nice, comfortable 65, much firmer. But a mattress isn't everything you need. Keep a schedule, a pre-bedtime routine that tells your body it's time to unwind. Try reading a book, stretching, or maybe yoga. That one's not for me. Avoid food or exercise before bed and minimize light by keeping your bedroom a screen-free zone. And if you're looking for your ideal mattress, take the online quiz at sleepnumber.com and discover smarter sleep. Visit sleepnumber.com/bedquiz to help you find a mattress that fits your needs. And believe me, I've been sleeping on one, and so has Tina, for the last 21 years because we love the bed and it does what we need it to do. Coming up, some students work very hard, spending late nights studying and sacrificing part of their social life to get great grades. So is it fair to give the slackers a free and easy A because of canceled classes from the China virus? We'll talk about that next. You've got the Lars Larson. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a Monday evening. Hope you are well, and I hope you stay away from the coronavirus or China virus and keep the rest of your family healthy as well. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every night at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll tonight, should college students and unemployed adults get a check from the stimulus program like everybody else? My answer to that would be no. And if you need some more explanation to that, I'd be glad to explain it to you. I also want to talk about what's going on in colleges right now, because colleges, well, they're trying to figure out a way through the mess they're in right now, because the academic burden on students amid the fallout of the coronavirus pandemic leaves some colleges trying to finish up at a distance, trying to figure out what do we do with students who are in the middle of a term, finishing up or heading into their spring term. I thought we'd talk about that with Eduardo Noret, who is a journalist with Campus Reform. Welcome back to the program, by the way, Eduardo.
Thanks for having me again.
So you quote one Ivy League professor as saying, well, just give every college student an automatic A. I'm not a fan of that, but tell me your reaction to that idea.
Well, I'm not a fan of it either. And so what's going on, this Columbia University professor wrote an op-ed basically saying, you know, it's not enough to move to a pass-fail system. So right now, as you mentioned, a lot of colleges and universities across the country are working on ways to make adjustments because of this coronavirus. We've been reporting on that at the Leadership Institute's Campus Reform, but people like her are taking this a step further. So she's saying it's not enough to maybe give students a pass-fail option, which, you know, is something that people can debate if they want to debate it. She's saying we need to just give everyone an A, regardless of whether they do the work, regardless of whether they pass the class, we need to give an A. You know, this is happening in other campuses across the country, Penn State. They want to give students the option to change their grade at the end of the semester after they've received final grades. Students at Cornell University are demanding an automatic pass regardless of the work they do. And so what this really does, it devalues what a degree really means. It devalues what passing a class really means if you can get the grade without doing the work.
I'm not sure what you gain. I mean, I understand that I always wanted A's in high school. I wanted A's for the college classes I took. I never finished, but the easy A means nothing. It's like handing out a blue ribbon or a participation trophy. Might work for T-ball with 6- and 7-year-olds. It shouldn't work with adults who should say, I got an A in math and I'm no good at math. I mean, is the only point to say, okay, all the students can feel good about their grades and they won't be unhappy with the university. And the university can say, well, we gave everybody an A, so everybody should be happy, and then we'll just move on to next term. Like you said, it devalues the whole idea. So, I mean, I'm not sure who benefits by giving everybody an automatic A or a participation trophy for showing up.
Well, it's not that these students aren't just benefiting either. It's not just that. Also, it's students who had, say you had an A or a B, you know, right before the coronavirus outbreak happened, and now your professor in your class is telling you, well, everyone's going to pass the class, everyone's going to get an A. What does that say to those students who put in the hard work? It's an insult to them, who they took the time. They work really, really hard, and now their A is not going to matter because, you know, for your listeners out there who may not be aware, a pass-fail format does not, you know, boost your GPA. So everyone passes the class, but that's not factored into the 4.0 scale. So, you know, I've talked to students and they've told me, hey, you know, I had an A right before this started and now I'm not going to get the benefits of all that hard work. And like you said, it's just unfortunate that we have to go to this extreme. It really devalues what it means to do well in a class. And these students are eventually going to go out into the real world. If they're used to scenarios where they get the credit, they get the rewards for work that they didn't do, they're in for a rude awakening once they get into the real world.
Yeah, they are, because the real world is going to tell them either produce or not. And Eduardo, I almost feel a political side to this, because over the last 20 years, I've seen more and more people saying, well, everyone's work is worthy. And I say, no, it's not. And they say, what do you mean? I said, well, the work of an armed robber is not worthy. The work of a methamphetamine cook is not worthy. And there are people who work tremendously hard but don't produce much of anything. And at that, I go back to a favorite physics teacher of mine who defined work as actually accomplishing something. If I push on the wall of a building all day long, I'm dripping in sweat by the end of the day, but I haven't moved the building an inch, I have accomplished no work in physics term. I put out a lot of effort, but I haven't accomplished any work. And the real world cares about work. You can come up with the most brilliant invention in the world, but if you never actually bring it to market and sell it, then you haven't accomplished anything. And there is kind of a meme that's been going on the last few years saying, well, everybody's work is worth $30 an hour. Well, why is that? Because some people's work is worth $300 an hour, and some people's work or effort doesn't actually produce anything, so it's not worth anything. But for some reason, politically, there are people who aren't comfortable with saying, your work is actually worth a lot. Maybe if you can shoot three-pointers on an NBA court all day long, your work is worth $10 million a year or better. And if you you can't, or if you go out and you start a business and you fail and you start a business and you fail, and we hear people say politically, well, that person should still be rewarded because they put a lot of effort out. That seems to be the message that's coming out of this college nonsense, that you worked hard, you got an A. And the guy who barely showed up for class, he gets an A or she gets an A as well, and that's it. It's more of a political message than it is a real message about the real world.
It is, and it's also another type of message. It's the message that says, you know, whenever you have difficulty in your life, whenever you have a challenge like we all are experiencing right now with the coronavirus, you can toss all obligations and responsibilities aside. And I don't think that's going to be helpful to them either. Look, another example was at Northwestern University, where professors told their students, you know, we're going to go ahead with final exam this semester. And the school administration actually jumped in and said, no, you are not to give students final exams because it could be too stressful. Now, imagine, this is the next generation that's going out into the world. As an example with the coronavirus, we're relying on medical professionals, nurses, people to in tough situations to take care of us. Are we preparing this generation of students to do that, to go into situations that are tough, that are challenging? They're not building character if they're being, you know, released from their responsibilities anytime the times get tough. And so we need to show these students, we need campuses to prepare students for difficult situations. I know they may be struggling right now with the coronavirus. We all are. It's not easy. It may not be easy, and it may continue to get tougher. But there are certain things that don't have to go out the window. And some of that is, you know, grading, testing. We don't have to give a free pass just because the coronavirus is going on.
I'm talking to Eduardo Noret, who's a journalist at Campus Reform. Eduardo, you made me think of, imagine being the person in that lab when Abbott Labs or Roche, a couple of the ones that were mentioned by the president in the Rose Garden today, you know, the boss comes down and says, we need a coronavirus test. It has to produce results in 5 minutes. It has to be quick. It has to, and it has to be accurate. And I need it by the end of the week. And you can imagine, if you think school is giving you a lot of stress, imagine that. Or imagine, like you said, the nurse or the doctor who's dealing with somebody who already has a whole bunch of medical problems, and now they've got coronavirus on top of it, and you say, save that person's life. And you say, we'll intubate him. We'll put every drug we know how to put into him. And you say, but it's still not working. And the message is, produce results. Save that person's life. If anybody thinks that college is the most stressful thing they're going to be up against, they should try being one of those nurses or doctors or vaccine researchers on the front lines of this thing.
Well, you say imagine it, and I really don't want to, because the thought is almost scary. Like you said, what if these people that we're relying on in our country right now said, hey, well, there's too much stress. Can we just not do it? Or you know, this is too difficult for us. You know, there would be many industries, many sectors of the economy, of society, that just would break down if people ran at the first sight of stress. And I think that's what's going on here. Again, I want to reiterate, look, there are situations across the country right now in college campuses that adjustments have to be made, just like we're making adjustments in the professional. Like, look, I'm working from home right now. I'm sure many people across the country are. But that doesn't mean that we can just relieve ourselves of all responsibility. Students have to realize that they have to focus hard. They can build character through this scenario without just demanding a free pass. It's really it's unbelievable that it's going on, but it's even more unbelievable that some of these colleges and administrations are allowing it and encouraging it.
Couldn't agree with you more. Eduardo, you're working at home. I'm working at home. My whole staff has been at home, all but one who has to go to the studio, but the rest of us have been working from home, and it presents a whole new set of challenges. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, I think it's kind of fun for real professionals. They look at that challenge and they say, you know what? We can still get it done despite the lousy situation we're in. Eduardo, thank you so much. Coming up in a moment, doctors and nurses at the front lines rewriting the playbook to fight the coronavirus. Should America give them some liability?
The Lars Larson Show.
Guarantee it to assure these states, these hospitals, that everybody who needs a ventilator will get a ventilator.
So here's what I'll tell you. I think we're in really good shape. This is a pandemic the likes of which nobody's seen before. I think we're in great shape. I think that, number one, we've distributed ventilators, a big deal. We've distributed vast numbers of ventilators, and we're prepared to do vast numbers. I think we're in great shape. I hope that's the case. I hope that we're going to have leftovers so we can help other people, other countries.
Everybody who needs one will be able to get a ventilator.
Look, don't be a cutie pie, okay? You know, everyone who needs one. Nobody's ever done what we've done. Nobody's done anything like we've been able to do. And everything I took over was a mess. It was a broken country in so many ways other than this. We had a bad testing system. We had a bad stockpile system. We had nothing in the stockpile system. So I wouldn't tell me what you tell, what, you know, like being a wise guy.
Being a wise guy. That's the president dealing with one of the people asking him questions over this past weekend. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And why? Because I'm a journalist as well. I put my opinion in, but I get your opinions in as well, and I give you facts. And if I happen to be wrong about something, I'm glad to correct the error. But that little exchange you saw between the president, you've got a reporter there making the kind of demand that reporters typically have never made of a president before. In fact, they've effectively set up an impossible situation. The reporter said, "Can you guarantee, standing here, that everybody in America who needs a ventilator will get a ventilator?" Now, do you know who that's up to? It's up to hospitals. It's up to states, which set the standards for their local hospitals. But who do they go to demand that he make it happen, that he guarantees that if a hospital out there somewhere, and there will be hospitals in New York that will be up against a real challenge, they are anticipating the kind of overload of their hospitals, which may leave them with 100 hospital beds, but they need 110, or 100 ICU beds, and they need 110. And I guess these reporters have taken the position that when a hospital has failed to plan and have the equipment on hand for something that, as the president correctly noted, we have never run into before, that it is the president of the United States who is responsible to make sure that the hospital that only has 100 ICU beds, but it has 110 people who are so sick they need an ICU bed, if it doesn't happen, it's because of the president. They want to set him up to fail. They want to say it is your job to make sure this happens. Well, let me point this out, because I've pointed it out before, and there aren't too many reporters that you're going to hear pointing this out. Whose job is it to decide what kind of hospitals operate within any state in the United States? It is the job of the states. And what have the states routinely done to hospitals? They give them what's called a CON, a Certificate of Need. Do you know there are literally times up until recently when if a hospital said, "Why, we have a CAT scanner in our hospital, but we think we want to add a second CAT scan so that if we have a rush of cases or MRIs or whatever, that we're able to meet that rush." Now, let me tell you something. America's hospital system is a very good one, and most of it is run. I looked the numbers up the other night because I wasn't familiar with the actual numbers. Do you know that about three-quarters of the hospitals in the United States are being run as private nonprofit hospitals? It's about 3,000 hospitals in the United States that are private nonprofit. Most of them are faith-based. Now, you want to really upset a liberal reporter out there like that joker? Tell him that most of those hospitals are run very, very nicely by people whose original underpinnings, their charter, is based on faith. It's based on the Catholic Church. It's based on other Christian churches. It's based on Judaism. That would really upset them. My God, do you mean some of the best hospitals, like St. Jude's, you know, and others, are hospitals based on faith? Wow, they even have saint in their name? I mean, in my neck of the woods, the hospitals are called things like St. Charles, or Emmanuel, or Good Samaritan, or St. Vincent. Do you know why they have names like that? Because they're run by faith-based organizations that do one hell of a job of running those things. No, I wasn't trying to be punny by saying one hell of a job based on faith-based organizations. But understand, the number of for-profit hospitals, and on Twitter over the last couple of weeks, I've seen a lot of people saying, well, you know why these hospitals are so bad? Because they're run by for-profit corporations. Do you know how many hospitals in the entire country are for-profit corporations? About 800 of them. How many are run by faith-based nonprofit organizations? About 3,000 plus. So it's about a 3-to-1 ratio. So before you start blaming profit-making corporations, and then look at things like Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is typically run as a nonprofit organization. In other words, whatever money they get, they pay out into building a bigger and better situation. And it's one of the reasons that probably 6 weeks ago now, when we started looking at on this show, why America is so very well prepared, why the World Health Organization actually ranks the United States as the single best prepared country in the world to deal with an emergency like this. You still may run short of resources, but we are the best prepared. Why? Because in America, we have about 32 ICU beds for every 100,000 Americans. Yeah. Now, how does that compare to Italy? They have less than 10 per 100,000. So we are about 3 times better prepared. Even when you compare us to countries like Germany, we're at about 32 beds per. Germany's at about 29. And all of the other countries, including Great Britain, are less than that. And do you know why? I'll tell you why. Because in the United States, you have faith-based organizations and some for-profit corporations that do that kind of work. What do they have in Italy? Socialized medicine. What do they have in Great Britain? Socialized medicine. How about Germany? Socialized medicine. And what does socialized medicine do? It runs the way most government agencies run. They run very, very spare. That is, they don't buy a lot of resources. They don't plan for big emergencies. And some of that lack of planning is coming through now. You see that we had a national stockpile of things like masks and personal protective equipment. And how thin was it? Well, it got run down to almost zero in 2009 during, let's see, who was that? Oh, right, Barack Hussein Obama. His administration oversaw the SARS epidemic. We ran the number of masks down from 100 million masks that we had in surplus or in storage as a reserve. They ran it down to almost nothing. And then the experts said, hey, we ought to replenish that stockpile. And did the Obama administration do that? Nope, they didn't. And it wouldn't have cost much. Those masks in mass production are less than a buck a piece. And they wanted to put 100 million back into the stockpile. And the Obama administration said no. Now, I know there are folks who are saying, well, why didn't the Trump administration replenish it? As the president said, he inherited a government that is flawed in so many different ways. I'll bet we could find other places where we're short of resources, too. But that's going to take a whole remaking of the entire system of government in America. You know, for all our sakes, we need to avoid crowds right now any way we possibly can. But what if you really need to go to the post office? What if you need postage to send out letters and packages? Don't worry. Stamps.com is here to help. With Stamps.com, you get great discounts, too. 5 cents off every first-class stamp and up to 40% off USPS shipping rates. And now, in addition to offering discount U.S. Postal service rates, Stamps.com offers UPS services with discount rates up to 62% on UPS. Plus, with Stamps.com, you don't even have to pay UPS residential surcharges. Stamps.com is a no-brainer, especially now. Saves you time, saves you money, keeps you safe in these crazy times. Right now, listeners get a special offer. It includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a digital scale without a long-term commitment. Go to Stamps.com, click on the mic, and type in Lars. That's Stamps.com and enter Lars. And stay safe, my friends.
Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Being stuck at home could be awfully frustrating, but at least you can watch television to pass the time. And there's a brand new National Geographic show. Well, it's not brand new. It's the show that is the continuation of a show, and it involves fishing for tuna. And Captain Dave Marciano has been fishing for tuna about as long as I've been on the radio. He is the star of Wicked Tuna on National Geographic, and he joins me now. Captain Dave, good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Got about 30 years in the fishing business out of Gloucester, Mass., and you and your crew on the Falcon take people out on the ocean, or, you know, at least by video take us out of the ocean, and you go after that tuna. So are you pretty excited about this season?
Oh, yeah. This season has been a great season. We've had, you know, a new addition of boats for folks who traditionally follow the show. We've had kind of that five original cast boats, and then this season we added three new boats, which just really built the competition. You know, these guys were top-notch fishermen, and it certainly, I believe, it adds a lot to the show as far as that whole competition thing. And it was great in spite of, you know, this show is kind of like sports. Everybody as their favorite players and the people they don't like and all that. And I think that's all what makes it fun and what makes it a good TV show. But regardless of what some people think of any of the guys, you know, in reality, it's been a great thing to be a part of and a whole lot of fun working with all the boats.
Now, when you started into the fishing business 3 decades ago, did you ever think you'd get involved in something like this where you become a household name and familiar to people literally all over the world?
Not in a million years. Not in a million years, to be honest with you. You know, that's why I believe I'm very fortunate to have this opportunity. It's been a great opportunity for myself, you know, and my kids who fish on the boat with me as my crew. You know, it's just been all around a great opportunity for all of us, you know, from a business sense, because not only do we do the commercial fishing that you see on the show, but we also, charters has always been part of our business. Charter fishing, where we take passengers out with us to go fishing. And for obvious reasons, with the popularity of the show, that end of our business has, you know, really taken off exponentially with the popularity of the show. So it's been, you know, a great opportunity for business all around.
Well, I got to tell you something. It's I only have the experience of having gone tuna fishing one time with a friend on a private boat, and we did hand lines. Now, you usually do rod and reel, right?
Yes. And you know, but I've caught plenty of fish, you know, going back, you know, quite a few years. You know, the first decade I fished for these fish, we used hand lines as well, and that was pretty commonplace, you know, back in the day. These are big fish. You know, the old timers called them horse mackerel, right? Because they were, you know, mackerel the size of a horse. They're in that mackerel family. And, you know, hand lines were quite common in the commercial end of the fishery because they were cheap to set up. You know, you could set up a hand line basket for, you know, $40 or $50 as opposed to, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 for one of the fancy rods and reels.
But no kidding.
And, you know, the thing about the rods and reels, though, is they're much safer. I'm sure you saw with the hand line, it can be a dangerous thing. You know, and a lot of the old timers who taught me about hand line fishing, you know, if I recall, I don't think there was a single one of them that still had all 10 of his fingers.
I was going to say, because when I was pulling hand lines in, I don't think I ever got into the big fish like you've got. But I mean, they were pretty good size, and I could see how you could get one of those lines wrapped around your finger. But I had one heck of a fun time, although it was a workout and a half. I mean, it was nice weather in our case, but it was we went out about 50 miles because my buddy, who knows how to do it really well, he said, we follow the temperature, and we get to the right temperature. And I said, how far out are we? He goes, about 50 miles. And I said, really 50? He goes, yep, 50 miles. And he says, but the temp is right here. We had a few sharks, but the little guys. But, boy, the tuna. And when the tuna would hit, it was like, okay, just start hauling them in because we're just going to keep hauling them in until we get them all on board.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a lot of fun. I used to love hand line fishing, but it's definitely an art form to do it safely.
No kidding. So anything, what are you going to, just give my audience a teaser for what's coming up in this season. What kind of controversies and conflicts are we going to see?
Well, if they've been watching, they've already seen some pretty good controversy because we're in season 9 now. And let's see, last Sunday was episode 5.
Yeah.
And there's been some great controversy that has really made a splash on social media. And, you know, I'm sure as you understand, in our world as a TV program, if it explodes on social media, it's usually a good thing for ratings. And there's been that pushback. And as far as, let's see, I have to be careful. I can't give too much away. Anything specific. I'll get in trouble with the bosses. But there's more yet to come. For I'm sure some of your audience has probably watched the show a little. And if they think what they've seen has been, exciting to this point, there's definitely more of that in store. We're only on episode 5, and we've got 15 episodes coming this year.
So how many more years or decades of fishing do you have in you, do you think?
Well, I hope a couple. That's been one of the blessings. Look, traditionally, fishermen like me, there's no retirement, right? You pretty much work and you drop, right? And that's not a complaint. That's just the nature of the business, right? You know, kind of like farmers. It's just something you do. But, you know, one of the benefits, you know, and I've said in other interviews, you know, because we get compensated for our time and our effort that we put in on participating on the TV show. And that's, you know, put me in a great position. You know, for 4 years ago now, I guess, four or five years ago, you know, I finally started, you know, retirement planning for myself and my wife. And, you know, for me, that's a dream I never had, you know what I mean? And we've got a way to go to do that. But, you know, it put me in the situation where, you know, we're very fortunate to be able to do it. But like a lot of other people in this country, we actually have something and we can think about, you know, we can dream about someday funding that retirement planning. And maybe when this is all over, you know, I'll be okay with not having to go fishing anymore. You know, I'd like to catch up and do some trout fishing on a nice quiet lake up in the mountains maybe someday. But, you know, before I could never even dream like that.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Captain Dave, it's a pleasure to have you back on. Thanks so much, and good luck with the rest of this year's season of Wicked Tuna with Captain Dave Marciano, who joins us, and he's been on the program before. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Lars.
Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
On the Lars Larson Show, which is, he's a conservative talk radio host.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
Honestly provocative talk.
This is a very big deal.
With Lars Larson. Larson.
Don't sit yet, you're going to like this.
No. Here's Lars Larson.
It's exciting to be here, especially at this time, to be able to be unified with our community. We want to be vigilant about what might be on what is out there in other places. We want to be careful about how we deal with it. But we do want to say to people, come to Chinatown. Here we are. We're, again, careful, safe, and come join us.
Dan, I want to point out that no cases of the coronavirus have been found here in Chinatown or San Francisco at all. So she's really just trying to point that out because they have seen a drop in business here.
Yeah, isn't this amazing? That was about 1 month ago. And that was Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, about a month ago saying, you want to be vigilant about what's coming at us. But hey, come on down to Chinatown and have a good time. For all of those reporters out there who want to find some fault with how the president has handled what is largely a state responsibility, and that is public health and the way that your hospitals are administered at the state level, why don't you go after Nancy Pelosi and ask her, why were you encouraging people to come on down to Chinatown to join with crowds of people just about a month ago and say, oh, yeah, we're aware of what's on the horizon? Just remember, a month ago, it's the 30th of March. So a month ago, at the end of February, we already knew that South Korea had been infected. We already knew that Wuhan, China had been infected. And by the end of February, we already knew that Italy had a problem. Italy, we didn't know the scope of it, but we knew that Italy had a problem. So why is it that when you hear somebody like that who said, yeah, go ahead, come on out, have a good time, including idiots like Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York City, who is also encouraging people to go out, mix, mingle, join the crowd. We all understand now that crowds is how this got spread. By the way, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Monday night in quarantine, about 4 weeks from me and my family and my crew. You know, Taiwan has successfully stemmed the spread of the coronavirus, and it's only 80 miles away from China and sees more than 10 million people a year fly in and out of Taiwan, into mainland China, and back to the island nation of Taiwan. Well, Taiwan has successfully stemmed the spread of the coronavirus. They've done a great job. So why has the World Health Organization locked them out of membership and ignored their warnings in late December? America has footed a $2 trillion check to pay for China's lies about the coronavirus and the consequences here. When this all comes to an end, can we send China the bill? And aside from the coronavirus, it's still an election year. How much of an impact is all of this going to have on campaigns and America's choice of a president? In fact, will they have a Democrat convention? Will there be airlines up and flying to make it happen? And cast a vote in my Twitter poll at LarsLarson.com and at Lars Larson Show. You'll find a brand new question each and every night. Two places, because we know that not all of you like Twitter. Tonight's question, should college students and unemployed adults get a stimulus check just like everybody else? By the way, I made it clear I'm not getting a stimulus check, and if I did, I think I'd endorse it and send it right back to the Treasury. I don't want to see our country take on more debt. But do I think those checks are absolutely essential for many people in America who are going through an unanticipated emergency and businesses that might just fail without some help? Yeah, I think from a practical standpoint, philosophically, I hate the idea. I hate the idea that the government has to bail people out. On the other hand, from a practical standpoint, do I want to see America back in business and back at work, let's hope within a couple of months? Absolutely, I do. So welcome to Monday on the program. We can call it Monday in Quarantine. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And we truly live in some strange times. Do you know an arrest warrant has been issued for a pastor in Tampa, Florida, who allegedly held two large Sunday services yesterday despite a stay-at-home order issued in the state? And on the other coast in Washington state, the government has actually set up a website where people can snitch on those that they see violating the safer-at-home order or shelter-in-place. And just to give you an idea of where we stand right now, if you take the official numbers out of China, and as we've been warning on this show, many of them may be way out of whack. The Chinese are telling us that they have a portion of the 37,000 deaths so far on planet Earth, 778,000 infected, 37,500 who have died. Yeah, they may be. I think it's more likely the Chinese have lied to us about what is going on. In the United States, the total cases as of tonight, about 160,000 people infected with the China virus. Nearly 3,000 people have died, and I guarantee you those numbers are changing. And let me tell you one of the most striking examples of that today. There was a six-hour period in New York City today, which is the current hotspot for China virus. During that six-hour period, one person died every 2.9 minutes. If you want a picture of how serious this is, for those of you who maybe a month or 6 weeks ago were telling me over and over again, this is just like the seasonal flu. It's really not that big a deal. We're going to get through this. We're overreacting to it. Imagine in New York City, one person dying every 3 minutes for six solid hours. The increase in infections in the United States since yesterday, 8%. Since last week, 1 week ago, 257% increase. The increase in deaths since yesterday went up by 10%, of almost 500 people. And since last week, deaths are up 374%. Those are a couple of ways of looking at it. In New York, 70,000 infected, more than 1,200 have died. In New Jersey, more than 16,000 infected, almost 200 people have died. In California, 6,500 infected with 135 deaths. And in Washington State, nearly 5,000 infected and more than 200 people have died. And the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, Dr. Deborah Birx, went on NBC television this morning and said she is very worried about every single city in the United States, and she projects a range of deaths in the United States by June 1 of approximately 100,000 to 200,000. The reason for that broad spread, that range of deaths, is because we don't know how bad it's going to be, nor how well some of the social distancing is going to work. 98 people died in New York City from coronavirus in less than 7 hours over the weekend. This is a terribly, terrible situation. Our Twitter poll tonight brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. AMAC has the conservative values I believe in, so I joined the group quite some time ago. And you should too. Just go to amac.us or call 888-262-2006. AMAC is better. Better for you and better for America as well. And then you have the amazing story from upstate New York. At the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, they have terminated a top executive for Facebook posts, Laura Krolzik, who is the vice president for external affairs, who, by the way, Ms. Krolzik had worked for a political campaign for Hillary Clinton. And she had an exchange in which she wished that people who are Trump supporters not be given ventilators and that they should simply die. Imagine that. Glad to have you with me on a Monday evening. Coming up, China lied to the world and the government just wrote a $2 trillion check. Is there a way to make China cover that bill? Five two seven seven. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. The largest single, in dollar terms, largest single piece of legislation ever passed by the United States government, by the Congress, by the House and the Senate, and then signed by the President, is the $2 trillion, well, they're calling it a stimulus package. I don't know that it's designed to stimulate the economy any more than it is designed simply to fill the gap that's been created by the arrival and now the impact of the China virus in the United States. I thought we'd talk about this with Dr. Gavin Clarkson, who's a 2020 Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in New Mexico and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy and Economic Development at the Bureau of Indian Affairs for the Trump administration. Dr. Clarkson, welcome back. And we've had better conversations about more interesting things, but none more consequential than this.
Yes, I mean, it's a lot has changed since the last time I was on your show, but one thing that hasn't changed is my strong opposition to the way that China has treated the American economy, and this coronavirus pandemic is merely the latest salvo in their efforts to destabilize, whether done intentionally or just through negligence. China has struck a severe blow to the American economy. And as I announced in my editorial that was published in the Washington Examiner this morning, because the president formally declared a national emergency, one of the powers that he has buried deep inside the National Emergency Act is the ability to confiscate $1.1 trillion of U.S. Treasury bonds that are held by Communist China, take them, liquidate them, and reimburse the taxpayer for at least half the cost of this economic rescue package.
Now, of course, the Chinese won't like that, and I'm not in favor of making the Chinese happy. I'm just worried about the strings they hold on us right now, which strings I'd like to see cut, like the fact that an awful lot of our pharmaceutical base, the stuff that's made that becomes the pills that Americans take every day, either to stay alive or to make themselves healthy, that stuff has to be brought home. And if the Chinese wanted to, if we did something like liquidating those, would the Chinese likely retaliate in a way that we can't, you know, compensate for? In other words, if the Chinese said, okay, fine, then all the shipments of all the things, all the pharmaceuticals or the pharmaceutical base elements that are currently going to America, we're going to freeze that as well.
Well, as the non-communist Chinese general Sun Tzu wrote in The Art of War centuries ago, if you know your enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the outcome of 100 battles. And we know the Chinese playbook. The first thing we'll do is what they're doing right now, which is going out and trying to do misinformation to try and say, oh, gee, the United States is no longer a safe haven. You should invest with us in China. But what they don't realize is how totally furious the rest of the world is with them. So step one of what I'm referring to as my frack China strategy is to go confiscate their treasury bonds and also freeze their assets, just like we did against Iran in 1979 when Iran took our citizens hostage. But the next step, step two, is to enlist our international allies to similarly target China for economic isolation. The British government, it's reported this morning, is absolutely infuriated with China. And if we invoked Article 5 of our NATO treaty, that would give all of our NATO allies that have been damaged with China the ability to go in and take similar steps against China. We also have similar provisions in Article 5 of our joint defense treaty with Japan, and in Article 4 of our joint defense treaty with Australia and New Zealand. So this is not just the U.S. acting unilaterally, but it is the entire world trying to make China responsible for their negligence.
I like the idea. Don't get me wrong, Dr. Clarkson. I like the idea of extracting our pound of flesh, or in this case, 1.1 trillion pounds of flesh from the Chinese, because as you point out, I mean, and this is something mainstream media don't seem to be spending a lot of time on. China knew about this problem, and China decided to keep the rest of the world in the dark. And I think we could get the support of the rest of the world in saying China has to pay.
Well, there's a study that came out of the UK that actually said that if China had come clean 3 weeks earlier than it did, 95% of the coronavirus cases that are going to pop up in the world would never have happened.
Yep.
So it's very clear. It is gross negligence of the highest order. And so the communist China is to blame. There is no doubt. Now, our own federal government obviously dropped the ball in terms of the testing process. But in terms of ultimate responsibility, it lies squarely with communist China. So first we have to go after their treasury bonds that they hold. But the thing is, those bonds are actually electronically here in the United States. We don't actually have to go grab paper out of China. The president could direct Secretary Mnuchin to go in and confiscate the bonds, and in 24 hours we could extract $1.1 trillion out of Chinese balance sheets and put it into the pockets of the American taxpayer as reimbursement.
Well, because just so people understand, what a bond is basically an IOU. We borrow money from them, and China is, I think, the largest foreign holder of U.S. bonds. There are people who believe that it's, you know, all of the bonds or the treasury bonds are owned by China. They're not. But they own, as you say, $1.1 trillion. It's an IOU. If we tear up the IOU, in effect, then we don't pay the money back, right?
Well, and that's not actually what I'm saying. Just tearing it up would be a default. And I'm very clearly not calling for a default, because that would destabilize the bond market, because actually Japan owns $1.2 trillion. So Japan is actually the largest bondholder, and we don't want to damage our allies. So what this is literally confiscating those bonds, turning around and reselling those bonds to non-communist Chinese purchasers. So we're not reducing the amount of the bonds that are on the market. We are just taking them from China, reselling them, just in the same way that when Iran took our citizens hostage, we confiscated $400 million of military equipment that Iran had paid for, and we turned around and resold it to non-Iranian participants. So this is very clearly not a default. It is a confiscation of assets off the Chinese balance sheet, and then we turn around and liquidate it by selling them to other participants to let them know that, yes, American bonds are the safest investment on the planet. We're just going to make it illegal for China to either buy, sell, or hold those bonds.
I agree. Now, by the way, Dr. Clarkson, I want you to back me up on this point if it's solid. if China had simply said to the United States and the rest of the world, we have a problem, here's what the problem is, as you said 3 weeks earlier, then it would have made a gigantic difference. China must have known that eventually we would know what they knew, and we would know that they had decided to keep us in the dark. And China is counting on us not calling them on it, right? Because there couldn't have been a time when China said, we have this massive infection in our own country. We have 10,000 Chinese nationals who come into the United States daily on airplane flights. There was no way in the world they believed that that disease would not make its way into the United States and probably do the same kind of thing here that it did there, which it is in the process of doing. We have a lot of people dying right now. New York City actually had a six-hour period today where there was a person dying every 3 minutes from this disease. So they must have known that we would eventually find out. Were they just counting on us saying, oh, okay, well, let's let bygones be bygones, and we won't pay attention to the fact that you knew about it, could have told us, and would have made a gigantic difference if you had?
I think China was probably counting on the fact that our response to them has been the same that it has been for decades, which is basically feckless nothing. Whereas this president is obviously taking a very different tack. But interestingly, you know, I've been a China hawk basically my entire life because my parents, my mom, in 1962, she was a DIA analyst. She actually identified China as a long-term strategic threat all the way back in 1962. And in fact, my parents met. Because my dad was the senior nuclear targeting strategist for NATO. My mom was writing a brief on the Chinese nuclear capability. So my parents' first date was a discussion of Chinese centrifuges and uranium hexafluoride, which apparently explains a lot about my childhood. But I learned about strategic nuclear deterrence at the dinner table. And what has been distressing is watching folks from multiple administrations just basically allow China to trample over international norms. I mean, we should have never let them in the WTO. I think, you know, I was one of the few voices all the way back in 2018 who was supporting President Trump in his economic policy against China, because it was very clear to me that the president was not going after tariffs against China for protectionist reasons. He was using it as an exercise of strategic deterrence.
Good plan. Dr. Clarkson,
the Lars Larson Show.
I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, for the last few weeks, I've been sharing with you some information that we get on this program about Taiwan, about coronavirus, about the World Health Organization, about the duplicity of the Chinese. And I pointed out a number of things. I have a dog in the fight. I was born in Taipei. Because my dad was in the Navy, in the United States Navy, and so was my mother, but she was out by that time, so I was born there. I spent the first 14 months of my life there, and I've always had a soft spot for the Taiwanese. They have done amazing things, taking a country from virtually third world status in 1959 when I was born there to very much first world status today. They are amazingly productive as a country. They make an amazing, I mean, for a tiny little piece of land, 13,000 square miles. If you're curious about how that compares, look up online, look up the square mileage of the state you live in, and then compare it to Taiwan at 13,000 square miles. And then imagine that small a piece of land with 23 million people in it, and then imagine a land that still produces about $15 billion worth of agricultural products every year and also produces a vast quantity of the world's electronic architecture. They make a lot of the laptop computers for the entire planet. They make a lot of the desktop computers for the entire planet. They have been innovative, and they are freedom-loving. Now, why does the World Health Organization ignore Taiwan? We told you that Taiwan warned the World Health Organization in late December that there was a brand new disease, a pneumonia of some kind, that was killing people in China. Now, this is before the CDC went to China on January 6th and said, you have a problem there. Can we help you out? In late December, Taiwan said there is a problem there, and they warned the World Health Organization. Taiwan is not a full member of the World Health Organization because everybody tries to kowtow to China. So as a result, China says to the United States, you must treat our country as one country, including Taiwan. They say the same thing to the World Health Organization. So literally, scientists from Taiwan who have been on the cutting edge of defending their country against this China virus, despite their close proximity, they're 80 miles from mainland China, despite the fact that they have 10 million people who fly back and forth between mainland China and Taiwan every single year, 10 million people a year make that flight. They have direct flights from Wuhan into Taipei, Taiwan. So the World Health Organization doesn't want to hear about Taiwan. I want to play a piece of audio. Bruce Alward, who is a Canadian doctor who helped lead a WHO mission to Wuhan, he was asked about whether or not WHO would give full membership to Taiwan. It's a short soundbite. Let's play it now.
I couldn't hear your question.
Okay, yeah. Let me repeat the question.
No, that's okay. Let's move to another one then.
Right, because I'm actually curious on talking about Taiwan as well, on Taiwan's case.
And at that point, the call went away. The point I'm trying to make is that the WHO is so anxious to ignore anything and everything about Taiwan, about the warning that came in late December. Imagine if the United States had been put on notice in late December by the mainland communist Chinese because of that warning from the capitalist, freedom-loving, democracy-loving Taiwanese. Imagine if we had been put on notice that early and could have taken the steps. As you just heard when you were talking to Dr. Clarkson, a three-week additional warning, not a month, but a three-week additional warning would have put us in a position to prevent about 95% of the cases that you're now seeing worldwide. We now have more than 750,000 people on this planet who have died, who have had the disease, and almost 40,000 people, if you believe the Chinese numbers from the mainland, if you believe that's the number. There are suggestions tonight, and we've been telling you about them earlier, that the number of deaths in mainland China is far higher than the communist Chinese are telling us about. They have been trying to hide this problem now for months. They didn't tell the world. They didn't tell the United States. They ignored the warnings of Taiwan. And now, when a reporter tries to ask this doctor with the WHO about Taiwan, he pretends not to hear the question and says, let's move on to the next question. That is a major problem. Let me tell you about a major problem that's happening here at home. The FDA has done something very smart. Now, we've talked about hydroxychloroquine. Now, it's a drug already used to treat malaria, some inflammatory ailments like lupus and other things. There's a small study, and I told you about it last week, out of France, that says if you combine hydroxychloroquine with what's called Z-Pak, that's the brand name for zithromycin, that those two drugs together may actually have some very positive effects for beating back a case of coronavirus. Well, the Food and Drug Administration has issued emergency authorization. This came down yesterday for hydroxychloroquine, already used. It's already out there. It has shown some anecdotal efficacy against coronavirus. The use of the drug paired with azithromycin, which is known as Z-Pak, have not been proven in a clinical trial, but that's going to take a long time. But given reported success, this is from Breitbart, in a growing number of small, non-randomized studies, as well as testimonials from doctors and patients about the off-label use of the drug, doctors are said to be prescribing the treatment to patients who are severely ill. Anecdotally, a lot of doctors are saying you can take it prophylactically. Now, that means you have to get this drug from a doctor. So the Food and Drug Administration issued this statement. They have issued an emergency use authorization to allow hydroxychloroquine sulfate and chloroquine phosphate products donated to the Strategic National Stockpile to be distributed and prescribed by doctors to hospitalized teenage and adult patients with COVID-19. understand, this is not something you go out and get on your own. You have to get it through your doctor. It has to be prescribed through a doctor. They also say that they have accepted 30 million doses of hydroxychloroquine sulfate donated by Sandoz, the Novartis Generics and Biosimilars Division, and 1 million doses of chloroquine phosphate donated by Bayer Pharmaceuticals. You know, those evil drug companies that so many of you love to hate. I don't hate the pharmaceutical companies. I know exactly what they're up against. I don't have any dog in the fight. I have no financial interest in them. But the pharma companies get badmouthed all the time in the United States. And it always flummoxes me why they get badmouthed. You have a company that operates in pharmaceuticals. The profits, people say, well, they make billions. Yes, and they invest tens of billions of dollars. If you're going to go into any business in which there is huge level of risk, there is huge opportunity to be sued and to be held liable for the use of a drug that doesn't do what you say it's going to do, that in that kind of case, you should be able to have some kind of protection. In this case, these big evil pharma companies are giving this drug to make sure that we have what's necessary to go out and treat people. And finally, the FDA has seen its way clear to actually say, yes, doctors can do that. Now, there's a real concern about this because of shortages. As the Health and Human Services folks note, use of the donated medications is expected to help ease supply pressures, and the FDA is working with manufacturers of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine to increase production to make sure the drugs are still available for malaria, lupus, and rheumatoid arthritis. The president has suggested that hydroxychloroquine could be effective, and he encouraged further study. His interest in the drug prompted pushback from the media, as usual. They're saying NBC News, for example, said that the president was giving Americans false hope, and Politico's Dan Diamond said the FDA decision came versus scant evidence and that career scientists have been skeptical. Well, they can be skeptical all they want. If it works and it saves lives, then I say let's go for it. Coming up, things are being canceled left and right, but what about elections? You can't really cancel those. Will the Democrat or Republican conventions actually happen? We'll talk with the head of the RNC coming up in just a moment on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want you to check out our Twitter poll. We put up a brand new question every day at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and LarsLarson.com on the web. And a little update on where we stand with coronavirus worldwide. The total number of people infected on planet Earth is now north of 750,000 people. More than 37,000 have died. In the United States, when I went to work a few hours ago, the number infected in the United States was below 150,000. It has now gone to more than 150,000. And the increase in the infections in the United States since yesterday, 8% since yesterday, 257% increase since 1 week ago. The increase in deaths since yesterday, up 10%, and since last week, 374%. And you might wonder, in an environment like that, is it even possible to pull off a major national election for president of the United States? Well, one of the people who's right at the front end of that is Ronna McDaniel, who is the chair of the Republican National Committee. We would invite on your counterpart from the Democrat Party, Ronna, but they're not willing to come on the program. Welcome back, by the way.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here with you.
They're welcome anytime, because I would have all kinds of questions for them about their current front-runner candidate, about the fact that Bernie has refused to drop out of the race, a number of issues like that. Apparently, Bernie is not as easily cheated out of an opportunity at the nomination as he was in 2016. Maybe they'll just have to figure a different payoff for him this time. But how is this going to happen this year? I mean, with the prediction that we're looking at maybe a peak of this in the United States in the next 2 to 3 weeks, and maybe back to something approaching normal, I don't know, 1st of June, optimistically, perhaps, get the economy, get the country back to business the way it has been, if we get there, and assuming we don't get hit again in the fall, the way the Spanish flu came back three different times, about 3 months apart. You're the head of the Republican National Committee. How are we going to accomplish an election and the primaries that lead up to it this year?
Well, you're exactly right. Obviously, everything's about how do we combat this coronavirus. Our president is a wartime president dealing with a global pandemic, and in a situation that nobody's ever faced. I mean, it's shut down the whole world, and right now the hotspot is the United States of America. But from an RNC perspective, we did have the ability to raise money in advance. We were in 23 states already. We had staff on the ground, so we have moved our entire operation into a virtual operation. Obviously, we're not knocking doors right now or holding rallies, but we are getting on the phone.
Let me ask you one more question about the RNC right now. Are you confident you'll be able to have a physical convention this year?
I am. Our convention is August 24th through the 27th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Again, we were in a very good shape before this break. We had a lot of our money already raised. We had staff on the ground. So this isn't preventing us from building an infrastructure. We already had the infrastructure in place. The Democrats were not in the same place. So this is going to be more challenging for them from a fundraising standpoint and their infrastructure, because they're at a standstill right now. So the advantage of preparing early and raising the money and putting boots on the ground as early as we did has definitely put us in a position where we feel like our convention will happen in August.
I mean, the reason I ask that is that one of the questions is, how do people get there? Right now, we don't have much in the way of a domestic airline industry at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping that, as the president said, if we can come out of this in June, then that gives us July and August to ramp back up. Our economy wants to start humming again. People want to start working. This is a unique crisis where we have all had to hunker down and stay at home and, for the public health, stop working. But once we're allowed to get out of our houses and start working, I think the American people are going to really speed this economy back into shape and want to get back to work and get this economy humming again. And that'll include air travel.
Well, and I'm glad to see it. And in fact, I anticipate that we're going to see Americans want to go back to work. And if I go back to 1918 and the Spanish flu, actually the United States went great guns for about a decade after the Spanish flu. So we had just ended a major world war. We had people coming home. We had a major flu that killed 2/3 of a million people at a time when the United States was much smaller. And yet the 1920s were really a very vigorous economy until October of 29. But we won't go into that right now. That was a different
exactly.
set of causes and all. But I'm just curious about that. The other thing I'm curious about, and I know you're not going to give away your political strategy to me, but at this point, I mean, unless they draft Cuomo, the odds are that Joe Biden will end up with the nomination. And yet he seems to have his share of problems, not the least of which is not just being confused about where he is and what question he's answering and that sort of thing. But he and his family have some rather interesting ties to China. And as far as I'm concerned, China lied to the United States and the rest of the world, and people died as a result of those lies. Does that become fair game politically to go after the Democrat Party front runner because he has the kind of ties that he and his family have had to China, ties worth lots and lots of money?
Well, I think China's going to be a critical point in this election, because if you look at President Trump, he ran as a candidate saying, we need to stop having a trade deficit with China. We should not have our supply chains in China for national security reasons. He was saying this 3 years ago, and look how right he was.
Yep.
And he stopped the travel from China early in January when others were calling that racist and xenophobic, as Democrats were pulling this impeachment hoax on our country. Joe Biden, on the other hand, has said China's not competition. His son made an enormous sum of money from China, which, by the way, isn't easy to do. China doesn't just give you money. And so there will
unless
be a real
they think
contract.
They're buying something that's worth the price, right?
Yeah. So I think there's going to be a real delving into where do these two presidents stand. I mean, there is no question right now that I think the American people recognize we don't want our pharmaceuticals being manufactured only in China. We don't want China having the supply chain for all of our companies. Because of Trump, so many companies that already started to move to Vietnam and Cambodia and other countries because they recognized that China was not a good actor. And I think this has brought to the forefront really how strong of a leader President Trump was heading into this situation.
You know, the other thing is, Ronna, I'm talking to Ronna McDaniel, who's the chair of the Republican National Committee. I see the media still hates the president with a passion. They say things to him. In fact, over the weekend, one of the hosts, Chuck Todd, asked Joe Biden to join him in saying that Trump has blood on his hands. And even Biden wasn't willing to go that far. And yet, I see that as, you know, we're going through a tough time. Millions of people out of work, likely to be tens of millions before, you know, for a short period of time. But if we get back to it, the approval ratings for the president on how he's handling this are going up. And the mainstream media seems to be ignoring those signals that are coming from the American public. Yes, it's a tough situation. Yes, it's being handled and it's gonna have an economic cost. But yes, we're happy with the way this man is handling it. And still in all, the media is doing everything it can to try to blame this on the president.
They are. And the media knows that the president's on TV every day. So you've seen them make more of an effort to be negative and divisive in a time of crisis, which has been shameful. I thought Chuck Todd asking Joe Biden, does the president have blood on his hands, was despicable.
You bet. Ronna, thank you.